So, meine Damen und Herren, we have nearly reached the end of our journey through the history of the English language. In Kürze erreichen wir Neuenglisch. Endhaltestelle. We will now cover the very last changes that take us up to the present day, and I hope you're as excited about this as I am. So, we'll be covering the usual suspects, spelling and sounds, morphology, syntax, we'll be talking about the lexicon, and finally we'll come to varieties and attitudes. Though as you'll see during this lecture, it's somewhat different during this period because often the changes that we're talking about can't be disentangled from varieties and attitudes in quite the same way that we can manage for the earlier periods. So what's going on during this time span? We're talking about 1700 to the present. And obviously, quite a lot has happened. The 18th century is particularly characterized by the Enlightenment. This is a period where we have reliance on science and reason, a sort of rebirth of humanistic thought. And this leads to social and political changes. We can link these, at least, to the Enlightenment to certain extents. For instance, the American independence, which began in 1776, the French Revolution, 1789, and abolition of the slave trade by the British Parliament. All of these, I mean, American independence people usually think of as a good thing, the French Revolution people often think of as a bad thing, but on the whole, all of these developments were motivated, or can be said to be motivated, by a sort of questioning of authority, a questioning of traditional power structures. So what do we get in the 19th century? We get Romanticism, which is to some extent a reaction to the Age of Reason, a reaction to the Enlightenment. This is a philosophical and literary movement that focuses on the individual, focuses on emotional experience and nationalism. You can see this partly as a reaction to the Enlightenment, but also partly as a reaction to something else that was going on during this time, which was the Industrial Revolution, which by the 19th century was in full swing. Remember, we took our first steps towards automation last time. We had the introduction of the printing press, the technologization of the world is taking over at this stage. We have agricultural societies giving way to industrial societies, we have urbanization, and we have increased use of machines and factories. And then the 20th century. I was tempted to skip over this because I kind of figure that everyone knows about the 20th century already, but you guys, some of you are so young that that might not even be true. So what happens in the 20th century? There's wars, really, really bad ones. Other stuff happens, like your parents were born. There are technological advancements. We move from not being able to fly as human beings, to be able to fly pretty much anywhere we like, very cheaply, as long as we don't mind hanging around while we wait for the Ryanair connection. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in the 20th century, and towards the end of this century, we can be said to be moving towards what you might think of as a post-industrial society, a society in which manufacturing of goods and physical produce is actually less important than services, in some sense, services and other things. And that takes us more or less up to where we are today in the 21st century. And obviously, this is not the end of the history of English. The history of English is still being written. And by learning English and participating in courses such as this one, you are helping to write it, directly or indirectly. But usually, we can talk about certain big names also associated with this period. And now, just on the literary domain, you might recognize some of these names. In the 18th century, not only great authors in the history of the English language, like Jonathan Swift, Jane Austen, Byron, Mary Shelley, we also get politicians, people like Thomas Paine in America, with poets like Robert Burns and William Blake. We have economists, you might say, like Adam Smith, philosophers like David Hume, and scientists like Newton. In the 19th century, here I've mostly just given you authors, but there's also Darwin in there to mix things up a bit, Charles Darwin. We've got all kinds of different writers. You might notice that this is the first period in which I've successfully managed to bias the selection of authors towards women, largely through inclusion of all three of the Bronte sisters. But there they are. The Bronte sisters, we've got Emily Dickinson in the United States, Elizabeth Gaskell, who was a very, very interesting Northern British writer, and many, many others. And then the 20th century again, there are names that will be more familiar to you, such as Tolkien, Rowling on the fantasy side of things. We have great social commentators, people like V.S. Naipaul, George Orwell, Harper Lee, poets, and so on and so forth. And so we've got an awful lot of material. This is just really the tip of the iceberg. And I said that last week, but for this week, it's really beyond the tip of the iceberg. This is like a tiny little needle hidden in a haystack on top of an iceberg or something. So this is the kind of thing that we have for the modern period. We have also excellent corpora. So this word, corpus, if you continue to study English, you do research on English, this is a very important resource, a corpus, plural, corpora, simply a collection of texts. And we'll come back later today to how you can use corpora to inform your study of the present day language, and indeed of the language historically. So, moving on to the sounds then, and the spelling. We'll start with the spelling, because really there isn't all that much to say for the spelling in this period. By 1700, as we saw last time, modern English spelling is already mostly fixed. All of the weird characters that were introduced in the Old English period have disappeared. There are still some rather interesting points of spelling to be seen, but they're more different conventions than things that are completely alien. So, for instance, you find extra capitalization. Nouns are often capitalized. If you think about this, this is actually not all that far off the sort of standard way of capitalizing things in German, right? Where nouns get capitalized by default. Except that in the English period at this time, it's kind of all over the place. So nouns were capitalized if they were thought to be particularly important or salient, maybe. But it's very hard to make any generalizations beyond that. And every now and then other stuff gets capitalized too, adjectives and so on and so forth. By 1850, on the other hand, spelling standardization is basically complete. So if you read the works of the Brontes or Dickens, you will have no trouble at all because the spelling is essentially, the spelling conventions are exactly the same as they are today. Having said that, it's not the case that all spelling variation has been eradicated. One that I talked about last time was the two different spellings of eyes. Do you spell it with a Z or with an S? The S is only used in Britain, the Z is used in both Britain and America, and this O-U-R versus O-R in words like color and labor, this ending is spelt with the U in Britain and with the O in the States, and various other varieties of English around the world make different choices between these variants, and individual speakers and users make choices between these variants. Like I said last time, I personally am a user of I's with a Z. And if you see an S, it's probably because the spell checker on Microsoft Word decided it was going to fix it for me. And that interestingly illustrates something else. The spell checker that you get in programs like Microsoft Word is a very prescriptive tool. It will often try and make you do things that actually, it'll try and enforce rules that don't really that don't really have any basis. But we'll come to that when we talk, for instance, about relative pronouns later on. Dictionaries start to play an important role. We saw our first dictionaries, and we'll talk more about dictionaries later on. For instance, Noah Webster's dictionary in America played a very, very important role in the spelling of English. You know, this is a sort of, people look to these dictionaries. These are not only thought of as descriptive tools, although most lexicographers are inherently descriptive, they want to describe the language as it exists, but people will also look to the dictionary for guidance on how to spell things, especially in formal situations. Now, what's interesting is that although, I mean, as we've seen, the English language was, the spelling was standardized. In fact, I'd say it was mostly fixed by 1700. A lot of it was largely fixed by about 1600, even 1500. This was underway. But the Great Vowel Shift was also underway, and that messed things up. We talked about that right at the start. And so, ever since, people have been proposing to reform English spelling. And this is an interesting matter, because English, as we talked about last time, doesn't have an academy. It also has a spelling that is so completely removed from its phonetics that if you start to try and bring it back, you kind of find that you want to go the whole way. And if you go the whole way, you end up with something like this. Right? This has been proposed, and not only proposed, this was actually brought to the British Parliament in 1949 by Mont Folloc, a Labour MP who devoted his life to the cause of spelling reform. There were many people who were very passionate about this. And the idea was to reform English spelling, to have a system where the sounds mapped more closely to the pronunciation. This eventually was unsuccessful, though it wasn't as unsuccessful as you might expect it to be. If it had been successful, then at least some of us might have been spelling English like this. And you know, that might not be entirely a bad thing, right? If you learn a spelling system that's actually consistent, where the same sound more or less always represents the same letters almost more or less always represent the same sounds, that's handy for a second language learner of the language. It's handy for a first language learner of the language. It's pretty much handy for anyone. The only problem is it conflicts so much with what we're used to. As the text says, we instinctively shrink from any change in what is familiar. And so these spelling reforms were never successful. And you might think about what would happen even if it had been. Because let's say the British Parliament passed a law that says, from now on, people have to spell things like this. Well, how influential would that be? First of all, the British Parliament is not the boss of everyone, right? The British Parliament we talked about something very important, American independence, right? That means that the Americans do not listen to what it gets said in the British Parliament anymore. And so they might quite well carry on using the spelling that they've always used. Australia might carry on using the spelling it's always used. What about, by this point, the very well-established colonies of the British Empire? Are they all going to suddenly change their spelling as well? Even in Britain, are people going to listen? Right? There are lots of Scottish people in Britain. They hate the government. I mean, actually, to be honest, most people hate the government, especially right now. But that's beside the point. Although it's not entirely beside the point. Because if you're going to follow the law, you know, you have to have some reason to do so. So this kind of thing is controversial, and it remains controversial, and it would be controversial even if it were implemented. And so, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you looked at it, spelling reform has never been successful in the UK. And I mean, you can compare your own experiences with this. You've probably all lived through the great Rechtschreibreform. And so maybe you're a little bit clearer than me on when you're supposed to use an S-set in German and when not. I still have problems with that. But, you know, this is trivial stuff compared to what would have been done to English if this kind of spelling reform had gone through. What about pronunciation then? Well, this is why I say that we can't extricate attitudes from linguistic change during this period, because correct pronunciation is becoming increasingly important. Initially, you might think of this as starting out, we've got a very class-divided society in Britain, and we have this division, and people want to be able to get up to improve their status in the world, to improve their standing. And one of the ways in which they are able to do so, or at least in which they think they're able to do so, is by improving their pronunciation, by pronouncing things the right way. So in the 18th century, we get dictionaries like Spence's Grand Repository of the English Language. I love it how people give dictionaries great names like this in the 18th century. You know, nowadays, they're just called dictionary. It's really not very exciting, but you know, if I wrote a dictionary, I'd probably call it something like this: Magnificent Storage House of Words, Fantastical and Wonderful. Yes? That's a very good question. So the question is why, so English in its earlier period definitely used the S that looks like an F, right? Or the one that's tall and has a little bar on it. The S set, actually I haven't come across that. You've seen that too?
Sure,
I don't know about that. But all right, so if you're watching this on the internet, make sure that you fact check this statement afterwards. But yeah, maybe there was an S set in the history of English too. Why that didn't take off, I really don't know. It didn't have much functional load, that was for sure. It was just a kind of a variant spelling of S. And its distribution was predictable, but it didn't really have any phonological correlate. Having said that, there's loads of stuff in the spelling of English that doesn't have any phonological correlate. So why that particular thing disappeared, I do not know, ultimately. It's an interesting question. It's one of the many questions you can ask about this period that you can actually start to study, investigate yourself using corpora, because there are a lot of publicly available great resources out there for precisely this. So back to the pronunciation then. This is something that was very much on people's minds. You might be familiar with this play, Pygmalion, by George Bernard Shaw. Bernard Shaw was a very famous playwright of the time and intellectual. He was also a great advocate of spelling reform, actually. He was one of the people who inspired Montfalcon to develop his new spelling. You might be familiar with this play, you might not. You might be familiar with the musical My Fair Lady, which is a version of this play developed in musical form. And it's about a professor of phonetics who actually, I should say, is a slightly implausible figure, right? Because one of the things that he's apparently able to do, if you say something, he can if you're British and you say something, he can identify which street you are from in Britain, right? Most of the professors of phonetics that I have met in my life have not been able to do this. But, you know, they can get reasonably close. You might be able to get within 20 miles if you're really, really good. Anyway, this professor, Henry Higgins, he takes it upon himself to train a Cockney girl to speak standard English. And this is basically the plot of the play. Shaw, of course, was very aware of how pronunciation worked socially. He made this very incisive observation. It's impossible for an Englishman to open his mouth without making some other Englishman despise him. And I think this is very true. Certainly, it's true to my own experience. I despise people all the time. And often, I think they despise me too. For instance, in My Fair Lady, we have one of the sentences that Henry Higgins makes his protege pronounce is this one: in Hampshire, Hereford, and Hartford, hurricanes hardly ever happen. And she is a speaker, Eliza is a speaker of a variety in which initial H is dropped. So what does she do? When she pronounces this sentence, she adds in extra H's. So she says things like, in Hampshire, Hereford, and Hartford, hurricanes hardly ever happen. Right? But this is a very artificial thing. I mean, if you're not familiar with the spelling of these words, and you don't have an H in the front of them, how do you know whether a word with a vowel at the front is supposed to have an H or not? This is something that remains variable. It's up to the present day. There are some words which have pronunciations with the H and without, even in the standard, particularly in French loan words. So, for instance, important word, hotel. I would say a hotel, but there are also people who say an hotel. And that's not low status at all. That's just a word that some people in British English, mostly I think older people, use and they pronounce without an H. Here's another one, one that I find quite funny, different distribution but still variable. Herb. I would say, and all British people would say herb, except possibly some of these Cockneys. Right? But the standard British form is herb with an H. The standard North American form is herb without the H and with the R pronounced as well. And I always find, I couldn't believe it when I heard people saying this. It seemed really strange to me. I didn't despise them because, you know, I'm a little bit more forgiving than that. But I only despise Englishmen anyway. But you know, this is remarkable that this level of variation persists in the language. So this H dropping is very, very prevalent. And there are many, many other changes going on today which are prescriptively judged as well. So, for instance, one of the things that's very, very common in London and the surrounding area is to pronounce an initial TH, written TH, as F. So rather than think, you might say, I think. And that is stigmatized, but it's increasingly common, and it's popping up all over the UK now, not only in the original places where it arose, like the southeast, but also there are studies demonstrating that it's got quite a strong foothold all around the country, even in Scotland, where usually they're very resistant to that sort of thing. So, pronunciation is judged, pronunciation is variable, still. What about regional pronunciations, then? Well, during the 19th and 20th centuries, it's been said that the regional variants had lost some of their distinctive features. In part, this is perhaps a consequence of greater urbanization, also greater mobility. Right? People can get around very, very easily. In the 18th century, you'd have to go on a long, long, long coach ride to get from anywhere to anywhere else. And that was only if you were lucky enough to be able to do that in the first place. These days, any Muppet can jump on a plane and fly between Manchester and London. And their carbon footprint, don't despise me, please. Their carbon footprint will be large. Anyway, that joke fell flat. There are variables here that some of them are more stigmatized than others. So for instance, there are northern varieties where the ch is still pronounced in words like nicht, and that's not stigmatized, actually. It's something that you don't hear very often, but there's no kind of stigma attached to it. Some of these other ones that I've got given below do have stigma attached to them. So for instance, in words like cow and house, these get pronounced coo and hoos in some varieties. And that is, in English, a stigmatized pronunciation. It has associations, rural associations in particular. Here's something we've seen earlier, the variable voicing in initial fricatives in the southern varieties. So rather than further and see, people will say things like verther and zee. And in the north, you will get long A, where you would have what was originally a long O. What's an original O? Actually, the A is the older form, in fact. So you get ham and twa for the words home and to. But again, that's not something you hear enormously often, and it's also something that's fairly heavily stigmatized. And this type of variant has been said to be actually on the decline over the 20th century in particular. I should mention that there is this wonderful resource. If you go onto the British Library's website, if you go onto the slides on Elias, you can click this link, and it gives you samples of different accents from all around the UK for you to listen to. One of the biggest areas of variation in English is the pronunciation of R. R post-vocalically weakens and lost is lost. This is lost relatively early, but it's not lost everywhere. So this changes the quality and quantity of the preceding vowel to some extent. This is in words like, well, like this one. So when I pronounce this, herb, there's really no R consonant in there, right? But it's also not heb, right? So the vowel has changed its quality. In an American variety, you wouldn't pronounce the H, but you would pronounce the R. So it's herb, with that R in there. This is something that becomes established in London and in much of England. Not all of England, even. But it doesn't become established in Scotland, doesn't become established in the southwest of England, and it doesn't become established in American English. There are varieties that retain this R. And in fact, that's why, you know, most of these varieties, because a lot of the original settlers, a lot of the important original settlers were Scottish and Irish. Particularly in places like Philadelphia and New York, which were pivotal in the establishment of the Americas in general. So there is variation. If you study a bit of sociolinguistics, you'll learn a bit more about that variation. You might hear about William Lebov's famous study where he asked people to give him directions to the fourth floor, or the fourth floor. And by that, he was able to make some conclusions about the correlation between social status and use or non-use of R. And initially, the new variant, the R-less variant, is less prestigious. But that changes over the history of English. What's interesting is that the R is retained when it occurs in between two vowels, in between words. So for instance, in a combination of words like tuner amp, it's not, this word on its own would be tuner, and this word on its own would be amp, but together I don't say tuner amp, I say tuner amp with a r, and that's the linking r, right? What's really interesting about this is that it actually crops up in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect an R to be. So this actually gets inserted in contexts where there was never an R in the first place. This is what's called intrusive R, because this R is an intruder. It doesn't belong there. If you say something like this, in British English, law and order, if you say them separately, law and order, if you say it together. Similarly here with saw, if you say saw-a, this gets pronounced as saw-a, saw-a film. Here we've got, you know, this slide has banana in it with a r at the end. So all of these words, any word that ends like this, especially words that end in schwa, they have this R inserted. And it's something very special about British English that phonologists get very, very excited about. And I mean, I can understand that because I'm not a phonologist, but I get kind of excited about it too. So let's move on to the morphology. One thing that you'll find a little curious when you read texts, especially as a speaker of German, you will find that pronouns are productively used with what you might think of as the wrong case in certain environments. So here's an example from Charles Dickens' Bleak House. Us London lawyers, right? This is the subject of the sentence. You expect with a subject to see a pronoun that's in the nominative, like, for instance, we London lawyers. But you don't, you see us London lawyers. And here, after that, we've got another example. Which involves ellipsis. It's a comparative construction. For they are quite as well educated as me. Again, this means quite as well as educated as I am. So you might think of this as being a subject case environment as well. You might think of I occurring here. They are quite as well educated as I. But that's not what you find. So from early modern English onwards, we start to get these cases that you wouldn't quite expect. And it actually works both way rounds. So what's more common is that you see oblique forms where you would expect nominative forms. And by oblique, all I mean is something that would be an accusative or a dative in earlier English. So an object case, basically, or the complement of a preposition. So here we've got a Shakespeare example from Merchant of Venice. All debts are cleared between you and I. Now, what's interesting is that people, this is the kind of thing, this between you and I construction is something, again, that people often get angry about and write into the newspaper about. And they'll say things like, this never would have happened in Shakespeare's day. But, yeah, it did. So, there's another example of the other way around. Sorry, not the other way around. This is a nominative as well. You have seen Othello and she together, not Othello and her together, right? Which is what you'd expect because this is an object. You have seen them. You would never say you have seen they. We can never say I have seen she, right? This is just crashingly bad. This is a terrible sentence, and it's not just me saying that. I can't imagine anyone saying this, right? Whereas these other examples get produced all the time. What's the difference? Well, the context where pronouns seem to get weird case is basically when they're part of a larger noun phrase. So when they occur, for instance, here, us London lawyers, the subject is not just us, the subject is us London lawyers. Here we've got you and I, not just I. We've got Othello and she. And the other case is where you get this kind of unexpected case is in ellipsis. Like I've said here, you've got this pronoun that stands on its own. You might think of it as a subject, but it doesn't have a verb following it. So you can think of it as a case of ellipsis. And these are the examples where you find weird case in present-day English. This, like I said, is stigmatized to a certain extent, but it's also extremely pervasive. The verbal system is doing interesting things during this period as well. So here, for instance, we find the form ain't. This is a contraction of be and not. So you can say, I ain't going to the shops. I ain't happy. And this it's very commonly found in the 18th century already as a contraction here for be plus not. Today, it's stigmatized. It's non-standard. But again, it's something that's commonly heard in speech, especially in certain areas. It's sort of a traditional, perhaps on the wane, but still very productive feature of the colloquial language. There are also many regularizations in the verbal paradigm. Now, one thing that's weird, and we've got there already in early modern English, verbs in English don't really inflect. The one place they do inflect is the third person singular. The third person singular only. What kind of an inflection system is that? What kind of a stupid person? If I was designing a language, it would definitely not have just that, right? Just this stupid S that you stick on for he, she, and it, and no other inflection. But that's how the English language has ended up. And that's what you guys have to deal with. Except that there are certain varieties. Again, mostly traditional varieties and stigmatized varieties, which have leveled the paradigm. In these varieties, there is no variation in the endings. And you can go one of two ways. So you can either do what happens in East Anglia. So in East Anglia, there is no third person singular S. So you see, for instance, I walk, you walk, and also he walk, she walk, it walk, no S. Right. This is the East Anglia variant. You find this in the east of England. In the north of England and in the southwest of England, instead, you find in some varieties that the opposite has happened. The S takes over the paradigm. So you get I walks and you walks, as well as he, she, and it walks. They walks. So there the S has become ubiquitous. And this kind of regularization happens in different ways in different varieties of English. Finally, in the domain of verbs, something else important that happens is something that we've seen throughout, and that's strong verbs becoming weak. So by this point, a lot of the strong verbs have become weak already. But during this period, we have certain verbs, particularly the ones that end in "-ide", so like chide. The past participle of chide used to be chidden. The past participle of abide would have been abode. I have abode. And it's become regularized, so it's abided, abided. Abode, interestingly, is retained. But abode is retained only as a noun. So in the word abode, you get the O, and that is because it's only this noun phrase. So you can refer to your home as your abode. Right. But the verb is regular, abide, abided, abided. Again, this is something that happens in a lot of Germanic languages. So something that I have sometimes liked to ask German speakers is what they think the past form of fechten is. A lot of people, or probably most people, would say fechtete, right? But there are also people who insist upon fochte. And so there is variation still. There are verbs moving from strong to weak. This seems to be some sort of consistent pressure throughout the history of the language for verbs to lose their strong status and become weak. And that's a rather weird thing if you think about it, that different languages, different Germanic languages throughout their history could have been subject to the same kind of pressure at the same kind of extent. How could that be? In fact. Nevertheless, the fact remains that it is. Strong verbs go weak. That is the general way the current is flowing, and has always been since the beginning of the English language. Now let's talk about the subjunctive, because if you remember Old and Middle English, Old and Middle English had a subjunctive mood. They very clearly had separate endings that were used for the subjunctive. And these were used to express, as we talked about before, an unreal and irrealist situation. These were cases like wish, fact, counterfactual, hypothetical. So we've got this example here. Ich will, dass du vergisst. I wish that you forget. Which means, in modern English, I want you to forget. In modern English, it's not even clear that there is a subjunctive. In fact, most linguists would say there just isn't one. This depends on how you define subjunctive. But there are no separate verbal forms for the subjunctive. All that happens in the case of the subjunctive is that you lose your third person singular S in regular verbs. So for instance, the example in the middle here, it is important that he leave, right? That's a subjunctive. If it was an indicative, it would be leaves with an S. But it's only a subjunctive in the sense that it doesn't have a consonant on the end. In terms of being a separate form, well, it's not distinct at all, right? It's just the same as the first person, the second person form, the plural form. It's just the same as the infinitive. So to really refer to this as a subjunctive is something that's heavily debated. Certainly as a morphological distinction, it doesn't seem to be very well justified. And so linguists will often say that English doesn't have a subjunctive. What's really interesting is that it's not only the case that there aren't many forms here, it's also the case that these structures are taken over by other types of thing. So I translated the Old English sentence, which is literally, I want that you forget, subjunctive, as I want you to forget. Use a non-finite clause. And that is how you mostly express this kind of meaning in modern English. You don't use a finite clause, you don't use a that clause, you use a to infinitive clause. The other thing you can do is to insert a modal. So for instance here, it is important that he should leave. That's just another way of rendering this. This, on its own, is somewhat archaic and stilted sounding to most speakers of English. It's not a very natural thing to produce. You would see it in written documents and in legal contexts and in that kind of thing, but it's not necessarily something that people produce very frequently in everyday usage. Instead, they would be more likely to use one of these two constructions down here, either the non-finite clause or a modal, to give that same nuance of modality, of irrealis. Okay, any questions about the morphology or about the phonology? Because I was going quite fast and I got too excited and I didn't stop. But it's fine, because there are almost never any questions anyway. So, great, okay. You know, I want you to surprise me next week. Come bursting with energy and ask me thousands of questions. Makes it easier for me because I have to prepare shorter lectures if you do that, right? So ask questions, you know, be bold. The worst thing that can happen is that you could be completely wrong and embarrass yourself. There, we have a question.
So what about the sentence, if I were rich or if I were a PhD? It's a regular
And
it also corresponds to the term bad, right?
Yes. So these are examples like, if I were rich. I didn't mention that on this slide, but be in the subjunctive does something slightly different. Be in general in modern English is weird because it has more agreement than any other verb. And be is the only verb where it even slightly makes sense to talk about a subjunctive in English. Now, note, it's still not a distinct ending, right? Basically, what you do is you take the past ending and you use it in the singular. So it's not incompatible with the idea that there is no subjunctive in English, but it is, that is probably the place where you see an unexpected verb form the most, because this subjunctive, this irrealis context. In this case, it's a counterfactual. If I were rich, and you use the were to illustrate that. In what's called the protasis of the conditional. Again, you don't have any distinct forms, but you do have the verb being used differently. And that is probably the place where you most commonly find vestiges of the old subjunctive. Any other questions? All right, syntax then. Now, we see auxiliaries on the rise throughout the history of English. There are a few of them in Old English already, but there are more of them, and you can stack them up more in the modern English language. If you have a situation like this, where, you know, let's say someone has gone out to scout. So you've got a situation where people are at war, and someone has gone to scout the enemy camp, you know, and periodically you hear bursts of gunfire, and there's a light that flashes, and you say, where's John? What's happened to John? Well, you know, based on what I've just heard, I think that he might have been being seen, right? And then you use four auxiliaries. So this is something that you don't see all that often again, but you see it just fine. It's perfectly grammatical. So not only do we have this new construction, which I'll talk about on the next slide, but we have new types of what's called quasi-modals. These are things that you don't often see in writing, right? If you see them written like this, it's usually because someone is trying to present colloquial speech. But these are actually incredibly widespread, and in speech you will hear them all the time. So, that one is slightly more American. Gonna is used pretty much everywhere. Have to, same. Wanna, also. Have to is original, because this have to comes from have to, right? You might say something like, for this course, I have to take an exam, right? But in practice, this is always pronounced the same way, which is have. I have to. Interestingly, there is devoicing there, right? This ver is pronounced for, voiceless counterpart. You would never get this the rest of the time. So if this have is used as a lexical verb, you know, like, I have a piece of chalk, you would never say, I have a piece of chalk. But you would when you have to. So you've got a sort of phonological assimilation process going on here. This F consonant is assimilated, it becomes unvoiced in proximity to this T, which is also unvoiced. So that's where you get this have to. It's modality. It has some sort of deontic modality. It means obligation, right? It's like must or should to a first approximation. You can see there's good discussion of these in Manfred Krug's book from 2000. Like I said, they crop up absolutely everywhere in speech. Even if you don't always see them written down. I call them quasi-modals because they don't display all of the properties of modals. For instance, I must do my homework and I have to do my homework. Those two work the same way. But you can ask questions with must. So, must I do my homework? You can't say, have to I do my homework. Right. So these quasi-modals don't show all of the behavior of normal modals. They're a little bit special. Some of them are quite old. So going to is first used before the early modern period in 1482 with a future tense meaning. But the written form gonna, G-O-N-N-A, is non-standard, so you don't often see it written down. Certainly in formal context, you will almost never see it written down. There's also a new passive in English. This is the get passive, right? The traditional passive, you would say something like, he was knocked out with a form of be. The new passive is get passive. It has, he got knocked out. This is almost as old. It was first attested in 1562. And if you want to find, if you wanna find when something is first attested, then you gonna have to look at the OED. The OED online is wonderful for checking the very first attestation of words. It's still rising in frequency today. So this get passive is something that you actually hear children doing an awful lot, often more than their parents, which is quite interesting. Originally, it started out as an eventive passive. It would never describe a state, only an event. Now it seems to be used for a state as well. So here's a naturally attested example. I got stuck in traffic for over an hour. Right. That's a state. We also get the progressive passive. Yes?
I read somewhere that the got passive is supposed to be used for negative.
That's also true. So this observation is that the get passive is used for negative events, things that affect you adversely, right? That is also still true to some extent. These two examples are both negative events, right? Unless you're some kind of masochist. But most people do not enjoy being knocked out, and most people definitely do not enjoy being stuck in traffic. These are negative events that affect you adversely. But for instance, you can find it in positive uses too. So for instance, he gave a great performance in the game, and afterwards he got congratulated by everyone. It's slightly less common. There is a tendency to use the get passive for negative events. It's slightly less common to use it for positive events, but you do find it used for them too. Yes?
It just occurs to me in American English, you would say get paid, and that's obviously positive, you get money, and that's, I think that's really the only way
Absolutely right. Get paid, okay? So getting paid is usually a good thing. Another thing that's often conceived of as a good thing is getting laid. If you don't know what that means, look it up, right? But these are not usually considered to be negative events, right? In fact, quite the opposite in many cases. So this is the new passive. Yes? Yeah, I was stuck in traffic for over an hour. It feels like there's still a nuance of meaning difference. This is typical of a sort of late stage of grammaticalization. We'll talk more about grammaticalization next week, because it's a long word and it's also very important. It's true that they don't quite feel the same. They don't quite feel the same. I was paid yesterday. I got paid yesterday. These are not quite the same. Yes, good observation again. There does seem to be a slight nuance of difference still between the get passive and the be passive. Any other comments or questions? When back in time a bit, we find the origins of the progressive passive. So the progressive passive is like this. You have be, and you have being, and you have a past participle. So for instance, his tooth was being pulled out. Earlier, in the earlier history of English, you would have this, what I consider to be a very weird construction, his tooth was pulling out. And this gets replaced, or it becomes replaced, or it is replaced, during the 18th and 19th centuries. At the end of the 18th century, you get the earliest examples. And then in the 19th century, as typically happens, people start to notice these examples and get angry about them. The progressive passive is described as uncouth. Uncouth, incidentally, is a wonderful word because uncouth has an un prefix on the front, but the corresponding positive adjective couth does not exist. So you can be uncouth, but you can never be couth. It's a very dismal state of being, uncouthness. The progressive passive is described as uncouth, and it's not found in English until the end of the 18th century. You start to get the first examples. What's really interesting about these, and there's a paper about this by Pratt and Dennison 2000, I've given this in the references, the early examples of this kind of progressive passive, not the very earliest, but a lot of the early ones, are found in the usage of this particular circle of famous poets. So for instance, Robert Southey, he's the one in the picture, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and William Wordsworth. Especially Wordsworth is still very, very well known. I wandered lonely as a cloud, and there's something about daffodils. And so these guys used a lot of progressive passives. And it's been suggested that they were deliberately doing this basically because they were trying to mess with the establishment. They're trying to be outrageous. They're trying to have an effect. And they're doing so by using this progressive passive. And what's really funny about that is that the progressive passive today is completely unobjectionable. Right? There is no judgment associated with it one way or the other. This sentence, it's got a lot of verbs in it, but who cares, right? It's not something that people get angry about anymore. So the progressive passive is something that developed during the modern English period, but has lost any stigma that was once attached to it. Finally, on the domain of syntax, I'm going to talk about relative clauses. In modern English, you can form relative clauses in more than one way. There are two types of relative clause. There are restrictive relatives, which serve to specify the referent. So for instance, the man I met, you're not just referring to some man, but it's the man such that I met him, that specific man. And then there are non-restrictive relatives. And the non-restrictive relatives serve to add information. And usually, You will see a comma around non-restrictive relatives in writing. In speech, there's usually a little pause or a different intonation pattern. So we have a non-restrictive relative here. Jane Austen, whose sentences were used above, was a modern English writer. In non-restrictive relatives, you have to use a WH word. In other relatives, in restrictive relatives, you can form them using either a that or a which. The book that I read or the book which I read. Microsoft Word will tell you that you should use that and never which for restrictive relatives. Do not believe Microsoft Word. Microsoft Word is lying to you, and I am telling you the truth. I am sticking it to the man by doing this. Microsoft might come round to my house and give me a good talking to. Seriously, this is something that the Microsoft Word grammar checker will underline in green for basically no reason. It is a fake prescriptive rule. So you should resist. You should resist. So there is variation. You get that, you get which. The preference is to use that, and that's particularly true in speech. So if you're speaking English, it's more normal to say the book that I read rather than the book which I read. You also can use zero, in fact. You can say the book I read, right, with no subordinator at all. That's another possibility. I won't talk about it anymore. But what's interesting is that the prescriptive rules, including the Microsoft Word spell checker and grammar checker, prefer the WH forms on the whole. Actually, not in this case, but in general. So with humans, for instance, you're supposed to use who. So the book that I read, but the man who I met. The man who I met, not the man that I met. In fact, the man that I met is fine, and lots of people will produce it, including me. But it's something that that there are prescriptive rules that say you ought to use who if you're talking about a person, but you don't have to. The other thing is preposition stranding, which, as we talked about, is very controversial, or was very controversial. Actually, do I have that? No. Preposition stranding, which I think we talked about last time, right, is you can only do it with that. So you can say the book that I read about, but you can't do the corresponding form without stranding. So you can't say the book about that I read. That's completely ungrammatical. That's not just prescriptively ruled out. That's just no one can do it. You can say the book about which I read. And so if you don't like preposition stranding, then the preference for any structure with a preposition in it is to use which. So there are various pressures conspiring in the direction of using more which and who and less that. But in fact, if you look at what people do, they mostly use that. And here, this is from a corpus, the corpus of spoken professional American English. So this is a collection of texts that you can use to investigate the English language. And when you look at the percentage in all kinds of nouns, so these are like the man, these are constructions like a man. They mostly, 80% of them, over 80% of them have that, and only a few of them have the WH form. So it's much more normal to say the book that I read rather than the book which I read, and even something like the man that I met rather than the man who I met, or the man which I met. One rather fun thing, and this is something that happens very recently, is that, or at least during the 20th century, is that the preposition like becomes a marker of reported speech or reported thought. So here, for instance, you've got an example, and I'm like, you know, I don't think so. And this like is equivalent to and I said, or I thought, or I was of the view. These are ways of expressing not only reported speech, but also reported thought, reported attitudes. So you can have this, for instance, is a reported attitude. You know, you can say something like, she's got an exam tomorrow, and as a result, she's like, ah, right? But actually, if you listen to what she's saying, she's probably not saying, ah, but she might be thinking it, okay? So this is reported thought, not reported speech. This great book by Sally Tagliamonte has great detail on what teenagers do. And it's important to know what teenagers do because they are the future, right? You don't want to listen to sort of washed up old farts like me. We will use old-fashioned words and old-fashioned phrases, but the teenagers, they are the people who you're going to have to do annoying business deals with and that kind of thing. So, you know, listen to what they say, understand the phrases. They use like an awful lot. There are other markers. They use a lot of so. You can understand these. These are not random, right? They're patterned. This is systematic variation. This book, Tagliamonte's book, Teen Talk, The Language of Adolescence, gives a great overview of this kind of feature. You can, if you want to listen to an audio version, there's an audio interview here where I actually do an interview with Tagliamonte about the main findings of this book. So that's something else. If you're feeling bored, you can take a nice warm bubble bath and listen to me interviewing a famous linguist about teenage language. Okay. So this is quite a prevalent feature of the modern language. So, let's move on now to talk about the lexicon. There's a lot going on in this period, but most of it is fairly predictable, really. In the domains of science and technology, we find a whole load of new words for new concepts, new ideas. Ultimately, as a result, you might think of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance before it. A just general broadening of the domains of academic inquiry. So you get a whole load of new words that would never have been used before, and new senses for old words. So for instance, tweet. Blog is a brand new word. It's actually a contraction, believe it or not. It's a contraction of the word weblog, which no one would use anymore. So you can think of it as a new word, but tweet, you just take a word for what birds do and you apply it to writing a message of no more than 140 characters and posting it on the internet for any Muppet to read. Words get new meaning. Similarly, a tank, right? There were tanks around before, there were tanks in the Middle English period, but most of them contained water or other such non-harmful ingredients, and they didn't drive around shooting people or blowing them up. Right, so that kind of tank is a 20th century development. You get specific terms for specific events. So here we've got Watergate, for instance. You've got the Cold War. These are not compositional, right? The Cold War is not just a war that was cold, right? It's not a war where everyone was constantly putting on extra layers of clothing. Right. It was a war. I'm not going to tell you about the Cold War. That's for another time. It's a specific historical event during the 20th century. Similarly with Watergate. Watergate was a specific political scandal. And what's wonderful about the gate suffix is that you can use it with other kinds of events. So various political scandals that continue to happen get described as something gate. You know, if a parliament is found to be buying too many biscuits, that event will be referred to as Biscuit Gate. Right, so this gate means political scandal, essentially. So there are many new words in various domains of science and technology. and also politics, art, music, different fields of inquiry. These words come from various different places. Some of them are the sources that we are already familiar with. So for instance, compounds, new compounds will emerge. Acid rain, the glass ceiling. Postmodern is a new derivation, right? You get the prefix post and you add it onto the word modern. You get loan words like angst, jungle, broccoli. But you also get other kinds of source, like phrase words, hit and run. That's a whole phrase, but you can use it as a word. You know, that was a hit and run event. You get clippings or merges. So decaf, for instance, is a clipping of the word decaffeinated. Blog is a clipping of the word weblog. Motel is a merger. It takes the word motor and hotel and merges them together. Brexit takes Britain and exit and merges them together. Acronyms or initialisms also become words SUV, ATM, LOL, or LOL. There are many, many different sources of vocabulary during this period. Here are some new words from this very last month. Let's see if you know what some of these mean. So post-truth was the Oxford English Dictionary's Word of the Year for 2016, which is an illustration of exactly how crap a year 2016 really was. We're in a post-truth era these days. Truth doesn't matter anymore. There are various other words here. Some of which you might be more or less familiar with. This word, woke, this is used for people who are aware of social justice issues, aware of discrimination issues. So someone who is woke, for instance, might be mean someone who is sensitive to discrimination on the grounds of race or color or gender. So that's what woke means. Hygge, which is a Danish word in origin. For some reason, everyone loves this word in England, and it means something like coziness or general feeling of comfortable warmth, right? I know people like this kind of word. I know that people usually get warm, fuzzy feelings in German if you talk about Geborgenheit, right? That is also one of these words. So that's another new word, June 2016, in the Oxford English Dictionary. An Eastern grip, this is something that's been around for a while. It's something you do in tennis. If you hold your racket in a certain way, it can be an Eastern grip. A MOOC, you've probably heard of these, massive online, what does the middle O stand for? Open, massive open online course, right? You can participate in these and learn a lot. This thing, Ziziva, this has just become, as of June 2017, the last word in the Oxford English Dictionary, replacing the previous contender, which was something like Zizigi. And this apparently is some kind of like virus organism or something. It's nothing good anyway. You don't want it, right? Sorry? A weevil? Oh, okay. A little weevil in America. Brilliant. Sorry? South American weevil, Ziziva, okay? The final word in the Oxford English Dictionary as of June 2017. So, up to the minute, cutting commentary in your History of English lecture. Obviously, during the 21st century and during the whole modern English period, there are various attitudes that arise. Pretty much everything we've talked about today has involved attitudes, because when you get change in the modern period, which is an era of prescriptivism, an era of judgmentalism, you cannot avoid this kind of attitude, and you cannot avoid, and when you talk about these changes, you have to know, you have to be aware of how this is used, of how this works. In this period, we get the first grammars. We'll start from the start, as is usual. So these guys, we've got the very famous Samuel Johnson up here, the slightly less famous Robert Louth, and the even less famous Lindley Murray. But actually, do not be fooled, because the influence of these guys was inversely proportional to their famousness. So Johnson is very well known for writing what is arguably the first real dictionary of the English language. And he also includes a grammar in his dictionary at the beginning. He's not trying to be prescriptive, but he actually ends up being, because he says things like, he talks about the verb to profound, which is not something that still really exists. He describes this as a barbarous word. Louth's an interesting one, because he's sometimes been described as the most prescriptive of the lot. But when you actually look at what Louth is doing, it's something a bit different. What Louth is doing is saying, if you want to speak like the rich people, you want to speak like this, right? And speaking like the rich people is useful, because then you can hang around with them and they'll invite them to your parties and so on and so forth. And maybe eventually you'll become rich yourself. And that's what Louth was saying, right? He's writing a manual for people to climb the social ladder with. If you read this book by the person with the incredibly long Dutch name, you will find out more about Louth and how he's been misrepresented in a lot of the literature. What's interesting is that then Louth, his grammar was moderately influential at the time, but not nearly as influential as Lindley Murray's English grammar. The first edition of this grammar was published in 1795, and it's actually kind of a hodgepodge. Murray takes bits from all over the place, but one of Murray's main sources is Louth. And when you look at Murray's grammar, you see very straightforwardly where he's just straight out plagiarized Louth. He's taken Louth's words and sort of maybe removed a few and added a few of his own, but it's basically Louth talking through the mouthpiece of Murray. But this was a massively influential grammar. We don't remember this guy, but he's left his traces on almost everything we do in the English language, in terms of prescriptivism at least. So this was a hugely influential grammar of the period. In terms of dictionaries, the dictionaries we saw last time were lists of words that were difficult, right? These were not attempts to be uniform, to be comprehensive. These were lists of hard words, words that people found challenging. In the 18th century, we find fewer of these. We start to get dictionaries that look like modern dictionaries with definitions. So John Kersey's New English Dictionary, published in 1702, has definitions of 28,000 words. So arguably, this is really the first modern definition. It doesn't look much like a present-day dictionary. And it also contains things that you might not think of as particularly useful in terms of definitions. So, for instance, a goat is defined simply as a beast, right? That is not helpful. That if you want to figure out what a goat is, then that really does not help your cause, right? You need descriptions, right? You need the little horns and the tufty beard and that kind of thing, right? But you can't just say a beast. That's a crap definition. Mind you, if I were writing a 28,000 word dictionary in the 18th century, I might not do very well either. So I shouldn't judge. Nathan Bailey, in the 1721 Universal Etymological English Dictionary, has 40,000 words and some etymological commentary. Johnson, in his famous dictionary, also has 40,000 words. But what he has that other people don't have is examples of usage. So he gives examples, a lot of examples from people like Shakespeare and Milton, you know, people who for him were the great examples of English writing from the second millennium AD. There's a fairly limited range of these people who he uses, but he does provide the examples so that people can see in context the way that a word is used. And that is a principle that most good modern dictionaries adhere to. They don't just have the definitions, they also give you examples. Having said that, Johnson also could be a little bit silly with some of his definitions. So Johnson, for instance, defines patron So the patron is someone who, you know, he pays for your efforts. He pays to support what you're doing. Johnson defines this as commonly a wretch who supports with insolence and is paid with flattery. Right? As you might have guessed, there is a backstory behind this, which is that Johnson did not like his patron very much. Right? Johnson's patron, Lord Chesterfield, was not nearly as supportive as Johnson thought he should have been. And as a result, he has been immortalized in a definition that basically attacks him. So let's all feel sorry for Lord Chesterfield, who is pretty much remembered only for being the butt of a joke in Samuel Johnson's 18th century dictionary. What about now? So we're still in the history of the English language. This is not a dead language. This is going on. You're making it. We're making it today. Prescriptivism is still alive and well. In the US, it's carried on. There's a tradition, people like Edwin Newman and William Safire with prescriptivist commentary. In the UK, people who comment usually write little books. So there's Lynn Truss's famous book, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. John Humphreys, who's mostly known as a radio presenter, but for some reason, he thinks that he can and should talk extensively about language as well. And Neville Gwynn, who I think was described by an esteemed linguistics colleague of mine as preposterous. So these figures are varyingly respected, but they all have a large platform, and they're very widely they're very widely read, very widely heard, unlike most linguists, for instance. Yes?
You said that a colleague of yours criticized one of them. Why don't more linguists call out these people as frauds? I guess they don't have a platform for it.
Yeah.
Why don't they try to get on
TV? That's a very good question. Why don't people take more action? Why don't people try and call these prescriptivists out on their nonsense? Some of these people are reasonably well informed. Some of them aren't. These ones I've listed up here are mostly not. Right? They actually. This is something I'll come on to in a minute. But why don't linguists actually challenge them? Well, sometimes they do. So, for instance, linguists with high profile, David Crystal in the UK has been trying to do this to a certain extent for years. Steven Pinker, every now and then, has a go at trying to correct people's misconceptions about language. But on the whole, it's quite hard. And it's perhaps harder than you might think it would be. Do people maybe want to be told how to use language? Is there some sort of subconscious desire to be dominated by a usage master? Well, I you know, it's hard to say, but the knowledge, the idea that there is a right and a wrong way to use the language, and that there are these people who should tell us, is very, very heavily ingrained. And this brings me on to the next point, which is something that I wanted to raise, because I know a lot of you in the room will be students on the Lehramt course. A lot of you will become English teachers, and you will be faced with this dilemma. And because what I'm telling you now, what I've been telling you for this course, and what you'll be told a lot by English linguists, is a lot of the rules that you will have been taught at school, and a lot of the rules that you will have to teach children, or you're supposed to teach children, are actually bullshit. And the question is, what do you do with that information? How do you react? So on the one hand, so for instance, let's take the rule that you shouldn't split an infinitive, right? So the classic example of Star Trek, to boldly go, well, you have to, adverb boldly, and then the verb form go. Prescriptivists hate those. And yet, it's been ingrained in the language for years. It doesn't cause any problems of communication, and it doesn't cause any issues at all. It's just that people will judge you if you do it, right? Certain people will say, that person put their adverb in the middle after the to, and therefore they're a complete idiot. Most of the time, that won't be important. But what happens if that person is responsible for deciding whether you get a job or not? You know, what happens if that person is responsible for your students, for whether they get a job or not? You know, you can teach your students that the split infinitive rule is nonsense, but ultimately, they're going to have to go out there into the world and face the prejudices of everyday people. And the people will not lose these prejudices overnight. So how do we do this? How do we go about it? How do we try and change the discourse? Well, obviously, we have conversations with people. If someone tells you not to use a split infinitive, you call them out on it. You say, you know, you do realize that rule is basically hocus pocus, you know? It's hard, but, you know, it needs to be done. Again, resist. But it's challenging in the context of education, where what you want is to create the best possible opportunities for your students. So what do you do? Well, one option is you teach the standard variety. Okay, fine. But you also make your students aware that this is just one variety. You make them aware that some of these rules are bogus, these split infinitive rules. You know, you tell them what I've just told you. You say, you know, you can split your infinitives if you want. It doesn't make any difference. But remember, if you do, there will be people out there who will judge you. And those people might have power. The other option is to just sort of let it go and to say, well, let's teach students about the different varieties that exist. Let's teach people about these differences. Let's teach people about things like split infinitives, the traditional errors that prescriptivists like to talk about. That's harder because there's more to do, and you have a limited amount of time. You have a specific educational remit. This is not something I'm presenting you with an answer to. I'm encouraging you, I'm challenging you to think about this. Think about how you want to teach English as a language. Think about what English actually is as a language and about its history and its grammar, and try and be, you know, try and retain your intellectual integrity at the same time as giving your students the best possible opportunities in life. That's up to you. I can't say too much from my lofty podium. But this is the kind of thing that it might be useful for you to think about. Either way, there are things that it is important to acknowledge. One of them, as I've already said, is that these prescriptive attitudes are very prevalent. You will encounter them. The other is that much of this prescriptivism is essentially little more than sort of thinly concealed racism or sexism or classism. Right? So if you hear someone sneering at someone for dropping their H's, hurricanes hardly ever happen, they're probably doing that as a kind of proxy for the fact that they want to laugh at someone who's poor, or they want to laugh at someone who's of a low social status. Now, you know, it's not okay to do that, but it is okay to laugh at people on linguistic grounds. Sometimes people say linguistic prejudice is the last form of acceptable prejudice. I'm not sure about that because I think a lot more prejudice is actually acceptable than it should be. But, you know, the point is that the linguistic facts, the variety that is the standard is, in a certain extent, arbitrary. You know, I've already said it's not better than any other variety of the language. But what is true is that the standard is always, always, always associated with the people who have the power. It's always associated with the politicians, with the journalists, with the lawyers, with the judges, and it's never associated with the poor people, the regular folks, the people who are trying to make a living, you know, the people who've been downtrodden and sort of beaten on throughout history. So when you're teaching a standard language ideology, you're also teaching a political ideology, and it's important to bear that in mind. Whatever you choose. Okay, I'm not going to say much about English dialects, mainly because I'm running out of time. But the important thing to note about the modern British English dialects is that this line here, this is the North-South divide. And in Britain, in England, there is no divide more important than North versus South. The main linguistic features here are things like ah versus ah. So do you say Bath or do you say Bath? In the north, they will say Bath. In the south, they will say "ah." In the north, they will say "oh," in words like up or up, but or but, duck or duck. And these words are, these features are very widespread. If you want to learn more about English dialect variation, a useful starting point is Game of Thrones, because the Stark family in Game of Thrones have, or at least are supposed to have, Northern British accents. Right, Sean Bean is particularly good in that series because he's using his natural Northern British accent. So you can hear, and the website I gave you earlier on will give you examples of those accents. Again, as usual, I will leave the summary as a revision guide for your homework for this week. I don't want you to do an exercise from the book this time. I want you to do something different, which is to go to this website where there are a bunch of UK dialect maps which show you how different linguistic features are distributed across Britain. Pick one of them. Pick one of them that interests you. Try and look at it. Figure out what the variation is, what things people say in different regions, what the standard is. And it will become as no surprise, given what I said earlier on, when I say that the standard is usually the form that's associated with London, with the seat of power. Not always, but usually. And that is your task for this week's tutorial. But otherwise, that is it for today. So I will see you next time for the last lecture in the series.